Too often we seek and settle for easy answers. We don't want to wrestle with the complexities or consider the viewpoints of others. We would rather live in our own little bubbles where our opinions and our beliefs and, yes, our prejudices get reinforced. And as a result, it is amazing what some people will believe to be true, even biblical truth. However, Jesus didn't offer too many easy answers. He often responded to the most important questions with questions rather than easy answers. And then he told these stories from which he expected his listeners to extract the truth for themselves. Now, the scene I am about to describe cannot be found in the Bible. I just imagine it every time I read one of Jesus's parables. I imagine a scene in which Jesus and his disciples have spent a long, busy day teaching and serving in the Galilee region, and they are settling down for the night. The fish have been caught and cleaned and cooked and consumed, and now the fire is burning down to embers. And finally, Jesus turns his back toward the fire. And after a few minutes, the disciples think he's asleep. Now, I'm making this up. You all realize that. One of them, likely Peter, because he always piped up first and the most, whispers to the others, "What in the world was he talking about today?" And another said that story about the pearl. Yeah, how about the mustard seed? Yeah, and the sheeps and the goats and the wineskins. What about that story where everybody gets paid the same, no matter how much they work? What does he mean by that? And on they go, discussing and debating those teachings in an effort to make the truth that Jesus taught become the truth for their lives. And in my imagination, Jesus, with his back to them and the fire, has a big grin on his face because they are doing exactly what he wanted them to do. Exactly what Jesus wants all of his followers to do. To not settle for easy, untested answers, but to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, to inspect and dissect that which gets passed off as truth. Now, this parable of the Good Samaritan is not as hard to grasp as some of Jesus' teachings, as long as we understand how radical it was for Jesus to make a despised Samaritan the hero of the story and to make the religious elites of his time the villains. If you read the Gospels and pay close attention, you will notice that Jesus consistently reserves his harshest words for the religiously pious, overly certain persons who thought they had it all figured out. And I believe Jesus has the same opinion about us today when we show no capacity to learn or grow or discover new light, and when we place this false sense of certainty above offering unconditional love to others. In the gospel lesson we just read, Jesus is asked a very important and straightforward question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? But before we consider his response, let's look at how Jesus did not respond to that important question. He did not take the lawyer through some quick, step-by-step plan for obtaining eternal life. Nor did he refer the questioner to simply follow the Ten Commandments or any other list of rules. Instead, he affirmed two commandments with Old Testament roots, and then he told a story, all of which focused on how we are to relate to God and to love one another. I have said from this pulpit before that the Bible is really about only two things: how we relate to God and how we relate to other people. Jesus was perfectly clear that those relationships to God and to others are to be rooted in love. Yet nothing seems to scare us more than being called to love unconditionally. We always want to add those requirements and restrictions that Jesus didn't put there. It is interesting and it is important to realize that Jesus reserves the word that we translate greatest for these two commandments: that we love God with all of our beings, and that we love others as ourselves. And Jesus offered this story so that he could define neighbor in a way without restrictions, a way that is radically inclusive. And it is out of that kind of love that we are to share the gospel, and we are to care for others. Likewise, the Apostle Paul, in that beautiful letter that he wrote to the Corinthians, I once heard someone say, Paul wasn't sitting there thinking, you know, I should write something for a wedding. No, that's not what the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, was written for. It works well. But he says in that beautiful description of love that faith, hope, and love remain, but the greatest of these is love. Have you ever noticed that both Jesus and Paul reserve the term greatest for love? My friend and colleague Bruce Gorley, your former church member who now lives in Montana, wrote an insightful article for the latest edition of Nurturing Faith Journal. And in the article, Bruce raises the question of why so many Christians across the nation keep pushing for posting the Ten Commandments in public, but they never won't talk about posting Jesus' greatest commandments. I was walking through a mall the other day and I saw someone had Ten Commandments, nice displays you could buy. So I couldn't help myself. Do you have any copies of the greatest commandments? What are those? Our reading from Jesus' parable today came from Luke's gospel. In Matthew's account, however, Jesus is asked this question about eternal life, and he responds likewise, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second one is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." But Matthew has Jesus adding these words, "And on these two commandments hang all the law and prophets." So if all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments, maybe we should be hanging them on our walls, but more importantly, hanging them in our hearts. I deeply believe that too many Christians today interpret Jesus by Leviticus rather than Leviticus by Jesus. Bruce and I have launched what we're calling the Jesus Worldview Initiative as a way of bringing Jesus back to the forefront of American Christianity. But doesn't that sound odd that Christians need a reminder that following Jesus is to be our highest priority? However much of American Christianity today gets focused on various interpretations of laws or conjure up some selective justifications for excluding people and discriminating against people, and Jesus gets pushed aside. And what he called the greatest is too often not what we give our attention to the most. Now, if you leave here today saying that I told you to ignore the Ten Commandments, you're not hearing me. But remember this, that Jesus saved his harshest words for the religious elite who slavishly followed the commandments of what we call the Old Testament. Those who took those 10 rules and stretched them into more than 600 rules. And they not only kept the rules, but they cast judgment on all who didn't do like they did. Yet, according to Jesus, they missed the point because they forgot what it meant to love God with all their being and to love others unconditionally. So Jesus made them the bad guys in this story. No wonder he ended up on a cross. Too often we get off course and we miss the greatest things that we are to be and to do. That is to hear and to heed God's call to love with all of our being, God and all others. Gordon Stewart is a Presbyterian minister and the author of a new book titled Be Still, Departures from Collective Madness. And in that book, he tells this story. I never met Bunny Benson, he writes, but I saw him many times. His name is etched in my mind from childhood. Every summer, my family would pack up the car and head for South Paris, Maine. We had little money, so we made the long trip from Philadelphia to spend 2 weeks of vacation with grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins in Maine. While my schoolmates ventured off to national parks and resorts, the Stewart family vacation was an immersion in the culture of South Paris, Maine, and a lesson in how society works. Bunny was a key figure in how things worked in South Paris. Bunny was not the Good Samaritan. He was the man lying in the ditch. I was 8 years old the first time I saw Benny, and it frightened me. Driving past the scene in the back seat of my uncle's fancy new Kaiser sedan, I spotted him lying there alone by the side of the road. Uncle Bob, there's a man in the ditch back there. He needs help. My uncle shook his head with some compassion, but we didn't stop. Is he dead? I asked. My cousin Dennis started to laugh. Oh, that's just Bunny Benson. He's a bum. He's the town drunk. Bunny was no stranger to my cousin or to my Uncle Bob. My uncle was the judge in town, first in his class at Harvard Law. He could have gone anywhere, but he set up practice in South Paris and bought a house on Porter Street. Uncle Bob was a community icon of spiritual and moral virtue. Benny was the icon of spiritual failure and moral depravity. That's how I understood the world until the day my cousin and I ventured into the basement on Porter Street. We found a six-pack of beer in the downstairs refrigerator, and then cartons of empty beer bottles. Dennis was horrified. I didn't know my father was a drinking man. I learned years later that my grandfather, who is married to a loyal member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, would sneak over to the house on Porter Street after dinner each night. He would say he was going for a little visit with Gertrude and Bob. You see, there are two societies in South Paris, one public and one private, one in the gutter and the other behind pulled drapes. In all the years I drove by Bunny lying by the roadside, I couldn't figure out for the life of me how we could revere the story of the Good Samaritan and still pass by like the priest and the Levite. It confused me until the day I realized, get this, that the people of South Paris needed Bunny more than Bunny needed them. They needed someone to be the community scapegoat, the moral outsider whose assigned role in town was to make everyone else feel good about themselves. As long as we have Bunny, we get to feel superior. Bunny is still the most important guy in town. With him, we never have to deal with who we are behind the pulled drapes of our own house. We get to hide in the basement. Well, that's the end of the story, but it's not really the end, is it? For there are still those words of Jesus confronting us, calling us to love the Lord our God with all of our hearts and souls and minds, and to love our neighbors as ourselves, even those who find themselves in different ditches than ours. Remember, these two are the greatest commandments, on which everything else the Bible teaches hangs. As we enter into this new year, may we commit ourselves to not see ourselves as more important than others, but to see ourselves and all others as created in the image of God, worthy of the same unconditional love that we want to receive. Let us love the Lord our God with all of our being, and let us love all of our neighbors as ourselves. Well, are you up to it? We're going to stand and sing together hymn number 383 as our time of commitment. And certainly when we move into a new calendar year, it's a wonderful opportunity to reflect, to remember, to look ahead, and to recommit ourselves to living more faithfully. Oh, we may not be the person who the rest of society sees and looks down on, but it's because we just hide ourselves better, because we all have those needs for forgiveness and change in our lives. So may this be a time of commitment, either in the privacy of where you stand and sing or before this church, which always invites you to profess your faith in Jesus Christ, to recommit yourself, or to become a part of this family. However you feel led, will you respond as we stand and sing together?